welcome again to today's podcast. What I thought we'd do today is I've got my mate Ian here, and what I thought we'd do is to reenact some of the questions that I get asked around the countryside all the time. And I want to really center this on some of the things that, you go through all of that uncertainty around when you're first starting out and what you should do first and then what you should do and I don't know where to start and all of that kind of stuff. So I thought, let's do a podcast on where to get going. Where do you start? What can you do first? What if you haven't got any money? You know, all of those questions about getting the momentum going, because it's all very well for us to sit here and talk about, you know, if you've got negative liquid investment properties or if you've got no cash flow but you've got properties and if you own your own home. But what if you don't? What if you're in that situation where you're just starting out? You know, it might be you're into your first job. I met some people today, some young real estate agents actually, who they're going, you know, look, I'm into real estate, I love real estate, and I'm selling real estate, but what do I do? Like, how do I get going? Because there's no good, you know, you can make a commission, which is an income basically on selling the thing, but how do I get going? What's my first deal? Or I've just started out on my first job. Today I spoke to a mother who said, you know, her son's been working for a couple of years and he's saved $50,000. You know, he's staying at home. He's saved $50,000. What should he do first? And there's so many answers to that. And that's what I want to cover today. So welcome, Ian.
Hi, how are you going?
Doing very well. So are you going to be the I don't know what to do investor?
Sure, I can do that.
You can do that?
I've been there before on a daily basis. Okay, so I want to start investing, and I've seen you speak before. I'm not sure whether to do a PPR first or an investment property, a principal place of residence. So should I buy my own home and live in it or buy an investment, because I really want to have my own home.
Okay. Generally speaking, women particularly want to have their own home. You know, they want their own home first. I'm not heavily biased towards your own home first or an investment property first. I actually think the question is more, can you afford a PPR where you need to live? Not want to live, I say need to live. And that might mean that you have to commute an hour or so to work or something, but obviously you can't commute 6 hours to work if that's the only place you can afford. So the first question is, can you afford within a reasonable commuting distance of where you have to work? Now, if the answer to that is yes, I think a PPR is not a bad idea. One, you can get the first home buyer's grant depending on what you buy in what state. Two, any gain that you make on that property, the capital gain on it can be tax-free because it's a principal place of residence. Three, depending on what state you're in, you can actually get more lenient laws around renting out other rooms and getting an income in, or dual occupancy, where perhaps you can't do it as investment property, but you can as a PPR. So that's in some states, not others. Others it's quite easy to do as a dual occupancy. But always, always make sure that that property is a property that you're gaining ground on. The last thing you want to do is go and buy an end-of-the-line developer's profit, because you're buying his profit. You're not getting any yourself. And the only control you've got over that is waiting for the market to move. So you have no control over that. So what you need to do is buy something you can do something with, buy something you can create value on through manufactured growth. That's what you need to be doing. Now, if the answer is no, I can't afford to live within, you know, a reasonable commuting distance of where I work, then the answer is absolutely go and do an investment property first. Go and do a deal that you can afford. I spoke to a young couple first starting out. Their father is a student of mine, and he sent his kids along to go and hear me speak. And they came up to me after the event and sort of said, you know, oh, we're in this position, you know, I don't know what to do. You know, we've spoken to Dad about it, and we've got our eye on this deal, and we've been through your DVDs with Dad, and he said that, you know, it's got to be a positive cash flow property, but we can do something with it. We've found a deal for $39,000. Do you think we should buy it? And, of course, I need a lot more answers around the property than that. However, I said, and well, look, if you can do something to it to increase its value, if it's easily rented, there is a demand for actually renting that property, and you know that you're going to have tenants in the property, my answer is really pretty simple. It's not going to hurt you, is it? You know, for a $39,000 deal, can't hurt you, so long as you can rent the thing. And, you know, and if it's particularly if you can do something to it to increase its value, it's then a stepping stone to the next thing. Now, it ticked all of those boxes, so it's like, well, hey, go do that first.
I think that's important too, because a lot of your students, when I first speak to them, have gone in and they've bought exactly that property that you described before, where it's a developer that's made, they're making money, and it's, they've not done their best with the money that they've had. And, you know, buying something that can do good things for you in the future is good. Another question.
Before you go on, I guess the question is, what if I've got one of them?
Yeah.
And I haven't, and you know, all my money's tied up in that, but you haven't got enough to actually refinance. Sometimes you're better off selling.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that you teach quite, you know, your opportunity cost analysis and working out whether that's worth keeping, whether it's returning you money, are you stuck and can't move forward? And if that's the thing that's stopping you moving forward, then that's what may need to shift. And, you know, that's one thing you taught me. I was very emotional about my properties. And the ones that I looked at that were stopping me moving forward, they had to go. They, you know, whether it be at a loss, and for mine, they were. Some, it's not always the way that you actually make a loss. But for me, it was, for Christine and I, it was a matter of looking at them and taking the loss and moving forward because of what you've taught us. So,
you know what? I spoke to somebody the other day who came to me very proudly. They've been a student of mine for a couple of years now. And they came up to me and they've done some other deals and they've made money and whatever. But they said to me, he said, you know what? He said, I'm finally doing what you told me to do 2 years ago. I said, what's that? He said, I did that, and he called it bloody opportunity cost analysis. And it said to sell, and he wouldn't sell, and he wouldn't sell, and he wouldn't sell. Those properties have done nothing for him in the last 2 years. They've held him back from doing a whole lot of other stuff. So he's finally bit the bullet and selling those. Now, that's not the case with everybody. You know, sometimes the opportunity cost analysis is saying even though it's negative, it's worth actually hanging on to because it's not stopping you and other things. But, you know, it's something that you certainly need to have in your consideration bucket.
Okay, we often get the question, I've only got a very small amount saved or I don't have any money at all right now.
Okay, don't have any money. Let's deal with that first. I've got no money. What can I do? All right, one of the things that you can do is, well, first of all, you've got to get yourself educated. That's the first thing. Because with knowledge, you're then valuable. Without knowledge, you're not valuable. That's a bit harsh, isn't it?
Uh-huh.
But what I mean by that is, with knowledge, you can turn that knowledge into money. And by getting yourself educated, for instance, and hanging around with a bunch of like-minded individuals like my community of students are, you know, you can find deals for other students that are time poor. Once you know, once you understand, once you can see the deals and you can do the feasibilities and things like that, find deals for other people to go and do. You know, even get out and get a spotter's fee license if you want so that you can actually charge through the varying state authorities to be able to do that. That's a great thing to do. And what you're also doing while you're doing that for somebody else is, even though you might be passing on a deal that makes $50,000, $150,000, right then and there you're learning the feasibility process, you're learning the research process, you're learning the jargon, you're talking to the agents, you're learning the area, you're becoming an expert. And in doing that, you know, if you can pass on a great deal to somebody else and they make money on it, fabulous. You know, you get paid a lump sum out of passing it on, great, that's even better. So do that first of all. Get yourself educated and then find deals for other people. That's a great way to start. Get yourself educated and do joint ventures with other people where, you know, you might be able to actually project manage the whole deal and take it through to fruition where somebody else may not have the time to actually do all of that stuff. You know, and then there's all of the no money down strategies that I can teach you about the negotiation side of how you can negotiate a deal where you don't physically have to put any money into the deal. And there's a stack of them as well. So there's lots of places to start. I don't care how financially malnourished you are. you've got a starting point. You can get out there and make it happen. You know, you've got to have the drive and you've got to take action. I'm not going to tell you it's going to be easy, but you can make it happen. And I can, you know, I can tell you countless stories of students that have done, you know, started from really, really compromised positions where, you know, not only had no money, but they might have been ill and had, you know, significant disabilities that have hindered them and all of these kind of things, that there's absolutely no excuse for you. The only excuse is lack of knowledge, and you can fix that. What else did you ask me? I've forgotten.
I've only got a little bit of money.
You've only got a little bit of money. Well, the same applies. I mean, you can go and do a cheapy deal if you could get into that. You go and do the deal you can do. Make sure it's a manufactured growth deal, though. Make sure it's a deal that you're building on and you can get somewhere with. You're not just buying an end-of-the-line deal that you can't go anywhere with. It's just another deal. This is where you have to, the less money you've got, the more selective you actually have to be, and go and do all the other stuff that I mentioned before for no money down.
And with a little bit of money too, rather than buying properties, you teach students how to use that money with other people and other properties to be able to increase the value. And then that
absolutely
will help you.
Seller JVs, all that stuff. Great thing to do.
You've touched on it a little bit already, but I've currently got investment properties and, you know, they're in my name, and should I keep them and what should I do with them? And, you know, the opportunity cost analysis is really that, isn't it?
There's the answer. Opportunity cost analysis, and do what it says. And you had to learn that one yourself, you know. How long did it take you before you actually decided, oh, maybe I do have to sell it?
Yeah, I was a different situation, like everyone is.
Oh, where are you now?
Oh, the rationalising. Yeah. Two years is when we finally bit the bullet. And the one that was hurting us the most was the first property we'd bought, and it was our first home, and, you know, there was emotional attachment to it and all the rest of it.
You want me to bring out the violins?
No, I'm over it now. You know, I thought I wanted to have that property in my portfolio forever, and now that I look back, I go, well, it was a nothing property. Now that I know what I know, we've moved on from that a lot. So.
And even though it was a nice property.
Oh, beautiful property, but doesn't, you know, was it doing anything for us?
And what could you have now? You know, that's the thing. What was a lovely property back then? You look now, your capacity is so much further ahead. You know, you go and buy an island.
I could. I could buy the whole of Ireland and Wales now too.
Put on the dream board.
Yeah, on the vision board. The thing with that too is, you know, we sold a property when we moved to Queensland so that we could buy another home in Queensland. And you know, the property market moved in the last little bit a lot. And people say, oh, don't you wish you would have kept Sydney? And my answer to that is no. One, because it would have been negative to start with if I kept it, because it was a beautiful principal place of residence. And secondly, the money that we took from that deal, out of that deal, we went off and made other money in other places, and more than what the capital growth was doing. So that's my next question. Should I be looking for capital growth?
Totally. Capital growth has got to be a big part of your portfolio. I like to say, though, that your minimum requirement should be at least neutral cash flow. Now, I'll qualify that a little bit. You might have this fabulous deal, which is negative cash flow, but it's got potential. It's got development potential. It's going to be rezoned next year. It's got this, that, whatever. And, yeah, there's genuinely significant upside for holding it for a couple of years and perhaps doing things to it or not. That's great, and it might be worthwhile holding that if that property is not stopping you from being able to continue to invest, and or go and find another property that's positively cash flowed and group the two together so that the positive cash flow property then supports the negative cash flow property, and you've got a little profit centre between the two properties that is neutrally geared. So that's a solution around it. The other thing is that, you know, if there's a, you can buy specifically in targeting areas where the market is going to grow, and that's great, but don't just rely on that. Go and do a manufactured growth deal in that target market that is growing, so then you get a double whammy. You're not only getting the manufactured growth, gain that you're making out of your efforts, you're also getting the, you know, the natural growth that may come out of that. My minimum requirement for holding a property long term is neutral cash flow. So whether that's on its own or if you group two properties together and say, okay, that's one property, that's a bundle of two properties, but they look after each other. And then that one that you're keeping that is negative, you better make sure it's doing something amazing for you from a growth perspective, or positive cash flow. So if you can't get it down positive cash flow by reducing debt is another way to be able to keep a property, is to get out there and do manufactured growth that you can, that you can reduce debt on by your other activities, simply to get out there and be able to hold it because it's got such low debt on it. Therefore, it's neutral or positive.
For me, you know, capital growth is important, and you know we've got a good portfolio in Sydney that works for us on a capital growth basis. Of course, they're not negative. They're sitting there at neutral or nicely passive. For me, when I'm looking at a property, I'm not discounting capital growth. I definitely look at capital growth. If it's a market that I'm investigating and I think it's going to go in downwards or sidewards for a long time, if I was going to hold that property long term, I'm more interested in making sure that I can buy that property and increase its value myself. Because then that way I'm fully in control of the capital growth because I've increased the capital. And that's what DIMP has taught me. So you go through, you do different strategies, and there's so many of them. You know, people say, oh, look, what strategy are you going to do? Are you going to renovate? Well, yeah, I'm going to probably renovate, but it's not the number one strategy. It's my lesser preferred strategy, because you don't get beautiful, nice skin follicle like me on my hands after 2 years being off the tools. I want to make sure I incorporate.
It's the hardest strategy.
It is a difficult strategy to do, and something that can, you know, with most of the strategies that that I now do in property, renovation is probably the one that has the most discrepancy on a budget. Because you don't know what you're going to open up and find behind walls. You don't know the mistakes that have been made before you, and the possible, you know, jump outs that can happen from that. Whereas the rest of the strategies, you can get fixed prices on most things. That's just one of those things you find difficult to do.
Let me ask you a question, Ian. If you had the choice to buy a $350,000 property in Sydney that was neutrally geared, mm-hmm, versus a $350,000 property in regional somewhere that was $10,000 positive cash flow, which would you take?
I would take, well, it's a sort of a tough one, that one, because regional still has longevity. It still has there.
Totally.
Sydney's where I would go to, though, predominantly because in 30 years' time, the cash flow on that regional town might be $20,000. Or let's say 10 years' time. Geez, I looked a long way ahead then. Can't even imagine 30 years from now. 10 years from now, that property in Sydney, on average, will be worth double. So it'll be worth $700,000. Mm. And it'll probably have the income equivalent to the regional one because the rents will grow with the density we've got. And also the regional town, you know, its value may have jumped another half, so it would be worth $500,000 and probably $12,000 income at that stage there. So I would take the metro every day of the week.
And that's a balance between where you're at in your cycle as well.
Absolutely.
You know, you're in a position where you don't need cash flow because you've already got your cash flow. So, you know, having a nice property that's just looking after itself is still quite okay. There's a lot of other factors. That's not a fair question to ask you, really.
Let me add something else to that. If the property in Sydney had no potential to have anything done to it, mm-hmm, then and the regional town one did, where I could actually increase its value myself,
correct,
I would choose the regional town one in that situation, yep, because I know I could get my money increased immediately,
yep,
and even sell part of it off and pay down the debt. So that property no longer would owe me $350,000, it'd probably owe me $200,000.
And you could rebound more quickly into, say,
that's
a Sydney,
right,
property or somewhere else.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's not a fair question because there are so many factors in there about your current position, your starting position, your goals, all of that kind of stuff that make that a not a straightforward answer.
I get lots of unfair questions from Dimmer.
Keeps you on your toes. Stop you whinging.
Okay. I have a large amount of cash and I've got a property with lots of equity, but I've got no job and the bank won't give me money.
Okay. Well, first of all, let's step back a little bit. If you think you're going to lose your job, you need to get market ready ASAP. You need to get in and get your loans up available equity raised as high as you can, as quickly as you can. So anyone who's sitting there in a job that they may or may not be secure in, or just somebody who is looking to retire in the next couple of years, get in there and get market ready right now before you start even thinking about pulling the pin or anything else. So the more you can get market ready, the easier it's going to be for you. Now, if you're going to if you're already past that and you've already lost your job or quit your job, and you've got equity and it's not released, things are going to be more difficult for you. Your LVRs are going to be lower, so you might only be able to borrow at, say, 50%. Or you might even have to, and wash my mouth out with soap, cross-securitise.
Oh, dear.
Because that might be the only way that you can actually get out there and start the ball rolling. Keep in mind, though, that you want to get out of that situation as quickly as possible. So get out there. Your first focus is going to have to be a cash flow deal, preferably one with manufactured growth as well. And that can get out and actually buy you a position, buy you serviceability by buying a heavily positively cash flow property. And that might be the thing to go and do.
So, so you'd be creating income by buying a positive yield property that is instantly.
Because the banks look at the income that property you're then buying as counting towards your serviceability.
And that's what you call a direct income deal.
That's a direct cash cow, that one.
Should I fix home loan right now?
Oh, I get this question all the time. My answer to that is this. We're at 40-year lows. Where do you think the interest rates are going to go? They're going to go up. However, 95% of the time, if you fix your interest rates, you are worse off than if you didn't and you just stuck with variable. And the reason for that is because what you're doing is you're betting your knowledge of the interest rate market against the bank's economists. 5% of the time, you're going to beat them. 95% of the time, they're going to get it right because they make the rules. They set where they think the fixed interest rate should be over that period of time. So, give you an example. Let's say the interest rate at the moment's 5%. And the fixed interest rate is, say, 6%, which is not at the moment. I'm just giving you an example, all right? For you to be better off, if you fixed your interest rate, the interest rate has to go up to 6 and then up to 7 for more than half the time, because you've gone up one interest rate percentage and then gone above it for another 1% for more than half the time for you to be better off in fixing your interest rates. Now, the reality of that actually happening is 5%. 5%, you're going to get it right. At the moment, the difference between the interest rate and the variable interest rate is very, very little. Now, what that tells me is that the bank's economists believe that the interest rates will remain low for quite some time. So that's what they're betting on happening. Now, if you don't think that's going to be the case, go and fix. I don't like fixing generally, because you're only going to fix on a property that you don't want to sell within the period of time. You don't want to go and refinance. You don't want to go and refinance with another bank. You don't want to extract any equity out of. You don't want to do anything with. And the likelihood of somebody in the property game sitting with a property for 2 or 3 years, dormant, stagnant, doing nothing, is yours and Buckley's.
Yeah, I've only ever fixed one loan and I never will fix again, because it cost us something like $28,000 to get out of the loan. Mm. And it was enormous. I was actually speaking to a mate the other day who in the 5% chance had fixed his home loan and was getting, and it went in the wrong way for the bank. And so he was paying, I think he was fixed at 8% or something, and they were paying 9%, although it was the other way. They were paying more in a savings account. So he pulled out $200,000 line of credit and he put it against and put it straight into a savings with the same bank. They were very unhappy about it, but they couldn't stop him from doing it. So
yeah, that was one of the few times, though. Very rarely does that happen. Very rarely, I tell you.
Why shouldn't I have my loans with the same bank?
How about you answer this one?
Well, by having your loans with the one lender, you are being controlled. Now, the standard, you know, the old days where you used to go and see the bank manager and used to sit in their office and he used to say, oh, look, we've got a property and we'll revalue that one and we'll take the equity and we'll use that as a deposit for the next one, and that you'd end up with a loan-to-value ratio of sometimes less than 80%. So that's all fine and good until you get to a point in time where either you get yourself into trouble financially or the bank just decides to change its policy and doesn't want to lend to your specific industry that you work in. You know, Dintmer's got many students that have been through this process that had they known Dintmer, they'd be far better off today. So when a bank calls in a loan, they decide that they don't like farmers anymore. They don't like the tourist industry. They don't like dairy. They don't like the rag trade. You know, the clothing trade. One of Dintmer's students had in excess of close to $8 million. Was it $8 million? No, $3 million worth of property.
$4 million
worth of property. And they gave her 6 weeks to refinance because they decided that, and she was making money, she was doing fine. She had a really beautiful factory commercial warehouse in Sydney. And in the end, she had to fight tooth and nail to end up with an 80% loan on a small unit that she managed to keep. All the rest, they close in. And it's not that. They give you 6 weeks and then they say, well, if you can't refinance in 6 weeks, we're putting you on penalty interest, which is, you know, if you've read your mortgage documents, is excessive. And when you're going to find a refinance company to try and get your loans moved in that 6 weeks, they're asking, why are you doing it? And you've got to tell them because that bank said that they didn't want me anymore. And you go, well, you know, because you've got to declare everything. You know, the cross-security slows people down as well. When you actually work out what your loan-to-value ratio is when you're with one bank, it's you're actually not using the full potential of the properties because they're putting extra protection into the deal. So having yourself all tied up with one bank is very dangerous. Now, at some point in time, the other question is, well, eventually I'm going to have a big portfolio and I'm going to run out of banks to go to. Now, if you go to all the banks and I've seen Dintmer educate banks before. she'll go to a new lender and they go, what are you doing here? Look, I don't understand the structure that you're putting together.
It takes me 2 months to educate them.
Yeah, and then you finally get the loans that you want out of them and then they go, okay, we want to give you more money. And you go, no, I don't want you to give me any more money. I'm going to the next one now. So eventually you'll come around and you'll have multiple properties with the same lender. Just remember that you want to specifically make sure that you're spread apart. And there is a clause in every lender's mortgage documents, bar one, that will mean that you are cross-securitised. I think there's only one lender that doesn't have that clause in it. And this is the sort of stuff that that gets taught by Dintmer, and at the three-day boot camp, you'll get to meet her mate Scott, who will explain it.
And some people are heavily cross-securitised. Everything's with the one bank. And it takes time to unravel. You know, I get people ask me all the time, you know, oh, should I rush out and I do this and what do you think I should do next? Half the time they end up having to unravel mistakes by jumping in without education. Life's not a race. It's not a limited thing where, you know, you're going to miss out if you don't jump in right now. Get yourself right first. Get your structures right. Get your mortgage structure right. Get yourself market ready. Get your head right. Get your knowledge right. And then you're going to make a heck of a lot more money when you do actually get out there and act, rather than have to go and undo mistakes.
Next question. How quick can I replace my income?
What position are you in?
That's a big question, isn't it?
It's a very big question. It can't be answered. You know, I've had students go out and replace their income within a matter of months. I've had students take 5 years, you know. It depends.
For me, 13 months is what it took me to become unemployable, is what I classify myself. For me, really, the answer to that question, and it doesn't matter who you are, is a book that Dintmer provides for the students called A Peg in the Sand. And until I'd actually sat down and set that peg in the sand, I really didn't know how to answer that question. So the answer to that question really is, put your peg in the sand and then go through that peg in the sand book and see whether that's possible with the deals and the strategies that are taught by Dintner. And when you can break that down on a step-by-step sequential basis,
guide you through that process.
It's a guide, and it helps you. And I can tell you from the perspective of a man, or a small man, a boy, it's a very difficult thing to put your thoughts down onto paper. It's one of the hardest things, and still one of the hardest things that I continue to do, because obviously you've got to reset and refocus. Because for me, you know, how much is enough is a question I get often asked, because, you know, we continue to do property, we continue to do more deals. And for me, my first ceiling, they call them glass ceilings, I don't think there is a glass ceiling, because when you hit them, you can't see through them. There's a process of resetting the peg in the sand and saying, well, where do I want to go from here? And so my first one was that $96,000 income from TAFE New South Wales. Hit that ceiling and reset again.
People don't believe you when you say, you know, you replaced $96,000. It's 100 grand, as we'll call it. People don't get that, you know, that's 100 grand. That's in 13 months... You set yourself up that you never have to work again. If you wanted to maintain that lifestyle that you had, I mean, obviously you've grown and you want a bigger lifestyle and whatever, which is always what happens, but if you wanted to maintain the lifestyle that you had there, you had 96 grand coming in, you did not have to do anything. You could just sit on the couch if you chose to. You can't do that. Everybody knows you can't do that. Well, you and I know we can't do that. But that's possible.
Yeah, I mean the irony with replacing income is that firstly that you think that you can sit on the couch and do nothing, and I tried to do that and I drove everyone nuts. Hence, you know, here I am talking to students and doing things that I love, which is teaching. You know, that's the number one thing and priority in my life.
That was one of the things I saw in you very early. That the thing that you miss the most is that interaction, that teaching process.
Yeah, that definitely, and thankfully having someone like Dintner standing outside being able to observe that, because I think it would have taken me a long time to actually get to the point where I realised that the teaching was the love of what I did at TAFE. It wasn't the actual TAFE job, it was the teaching part of it. But going beyond that first income replacement is you know, for some people they'd be happy. I was recently talking to a business coach around who had done some studies on property people, and the irony is that the property people that replaced their income, none of them that she'd interviewed in a study that she'd done, go home and sit and do nothing.
Yeah.
They all find something to do in their life, whether it be increasing their property portfolio or doing charity work. They filled their life with stuff, and it's the type of person that you end up being.
Correct.
Although you've got a student in Byron Bay that's quite happy making ceramic pots all day
that's
long.
That's true. But he's doing what he loves, you know. That's pottery, well, hey, that's what it is.
So, I mean, it's a varied choice of students that Dintner has that, you know, they go from, well, and it's a question I ask students all the time. When you break down exactly how much does it take for you to live on a daily basis or on a weekly basis, have you ever done that? Because, you know, if you didn't have a job, if tomorrow you sat at home, you would either have a rent or mortgage to pay, or maybe not. Maybe you own your home outright, but you've still got council rates and insurance to pay. You've still got to put food in the fridge. Because you don't have a job anymore, you don't need to drive to work anymore, so you can get rid of the car and you don't have rego to pay or fuel to pay. You may have to catch a bus every now and then, so you've got to take that. So what is it that you actually really need on a weekly basis to live? And when you actually break that down and work it out, sometimes it's a lot less than half the wage if that's what you wanted to do for the rest of your life.
And the other side of income replacement is, imagine if you had from 9 o'clock to 5 o'clock every day to do something to replace that income, to work on your property business.
Hmm.
How much you could get done.
Extra because, work, yeah.
Because, you know, while you're working to earn a wage, but, you know, you're making somebody else profit. So imagine if you had that time to make your own profit. Gosh, how much could you do?
Hmm.
And that's a thought process that I don't think a lot of people allow themselves the opportunity to think. They don't even see it's a possibility for them.
Yeah, and it's another lesson, again, that Dintner taught me, that, you know, once you are looking after your property business, you still have to have a space in your home that is your office, that is the place that you go to work. You know, and we've just recently moved into a waterfront property, 2 acres of waterfront, we've got that place, though I still haven't structured that yet, and it takes some extra time to get your office set up and do all of that. You know, living in that property there is, they say it's expensive to live on the waterfront, and it's not because you have to buy the property expensive, it's because once you live there, you've got to buy a boat and a jet ski and a big lawnmower, the biggest lawnmower in the whole area, because you've got to make the most noise.
Just go to the dump, Ian.
Yeah, I could pick one up at the tip, no problem at all. So for any tours of the tip, come and contact me. I think, you know, these questions, they're very simple questions, but can be confusing for when you're first starting up.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy for me to sit back here 5 years down the track, 4 or 5 years down the track, and say, you know what, that's such an easy question to answer, though I've got 5 years of looking at the same things over and over again, and really...
And emotional growth.
That's right.
And that's a big thing.
And I say it often, that people sit back here from a zero start point, and I say to them, you know, I remember how overwhelming it was to think about how I'm going to get to the point and the type of properties I'm going to need to get to income replacement. The end result is I look back now and it wasn't hard work. It was a lot of work. It wasn't hard. It was actually quite simple. But the one key component of what I did 5 years ago was join a program that taught me that. You know, I'd much rather pay to be mentored in a program for a small amount of money than actually go out and do a deal thinking, and I would have, previous to that, egotistically go and buy properties where you're going to end up losing much, much more than the mentorship.
You think about it. I mean, you openly say that you reckon you lost somewhere around $250,000, $300,000,
yep,
correcting your mistakes.
Yeah, $300,000 is what it cost on our sell down.
So $300,000 is your cost of education through trial and error versus coming along to my program, learning the process and then implementing that and obviously having a very different result. So people don't realise just how valuable, you know, getting that foundation stuff right is.
Forgetting the cost, the heartache of that loss, you know, it's put me into a fantastic situation because I learnt the hard way. Just learn the easy way, you know.
You don't have to learn the hard way.
You don't have to be me. Just, you know, it's one of these things I see people grappling with. I remember sitting in an event and watching Dibner for the first time, and for me, I was sold. I was to the back of the room, and I could not, at the time, in our financial position, with the negative gearing we had, we couldn't afford to be part of a program. Although the program that we joined, which was Dibner's, straight away, just on the debt reduction strategies, we saw that there was ways of actually saving money far more than what it was costing us to be part of a group. You know,
and the question is, could you afford not to?
That's exactly right. So if you're struggling to make the first payment, what's going to change? One thing for sure is I did a degree in education and I came out the back end. That, you know, what's that, $60,000, $80,000. At the back end of that, I had a job of $96,000. That was a salary forever, where I had to turn up to work for that. Whereas the small amount of money it had cost for the mentorship, I ended up, you know, 4 or 5 years down the track, not needing to work if I choose not to. You know, it's like there's just such a vast difference, and it's amazing journey. I said it, journey, to go through that process, to have the flexibility of getting up in the morning and doing what you choose to do. It's such, the freedom of that's amazing.
Well, guys, we better end it on that. Thanks for listening. This is www.iloverealestate.tv. Join into the next podcast. Thank you again, Ian, for sharing. You're always wonderful to have on and to share your thoughts and wisdom. And we will be back again to talk to you very, very soon. So thanks heaps, guys. Catch you again next time. Bye-bye.
See ya.